Shrink Wrap Radio number 439, Psychedelics and Their Power to Heal, with journalist and author Tom Schroeder.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Tom Schroeder, author and former editor of the Washington Post magazine, about his latest book, Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. For more information about Tom Schroeder, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Tom Schroeder, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, David.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you on the show to discuss your new book, Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. And this is a topic my listeners will know that I have some longstanding interest in, and I've conducted some other interviews about psychedelics. And I happened to see an ad for your book in the New Yorker magazine, in one of the inserts, and right away I thought, hey, I better look into this, a new book on psychedelics. Let's see what's going on here.
Well, good to know that ads have some positive impact.
Yeah, right. Sometimes they do. Yeah. You know, the title kind of caught me, and so I went online to went on to Amazon to kind of see what I could find out about the book, and I said, yeah, this is going to be right up my alley. So how did you come to write this book?
Well, I mean, actually, that's a story I tell in the foreword of the book, and it's kind of a long but interesting story, I felt.
We got lots of time, so.
Okay. Well, when I was a student at the University of Florida in the early 1970s to mid 1970s, I had my introduction to psychedelics, as many people in that time frame did.
Yeah.
And we would go out into the cow pastures that surrounded this campus in Central Florida, and we would, you know, slip through the fences and find, not that I'm recommending this, but find in the cow patties these mushrooms growing, psilocybin mushrooms, and we'd pluck them out and, you know, boil them and drink it with tea. And I had some really interesting experiences. And even from the beginning, even back then, you know, I was doing this for self-knowledge. I wasn't doing it as a party, you know, thinking that it was going to be a party drug or anything like that.
Okay.
I was really interested in self-exploration. And I had some experiences that really stuck with me. And just to give you the example that I use, there was one time where as the drug took effect, as often happened, you know, it was uncomfortable at first. And I began to feel, you know, all these very acutely, all these little fears and anxieties that had been going around in my head. And they became accentuated to the point where I felt like there was this giant boulder on my chest and I could barely breathe. And it almost became this palpable, as sometimes it will happen under the influence of psychedelics. This became more than a metaphor to me. It was almost like a real boulder.
Yeah.
And I could, I could see it and I could feel it. And then I had this vision. And that vision was that this boulder that was weighing me down, I was actually holding to myself. And I was using a lot of effort to hold this weight that was crushing me, and that all I had to do was let my arms apart and the weight would fall away. And that's what I did. And I had that experience of simply deciding to let go of these fears and anxieties and having the experience of seeing them just disappear. And that insight that to a certain degree, we choose to feel the negative feelings that we have. That it's a choice we make and that we can choose just to let them go. That stayed with me my whole life. And even though, you know, after college, I got a job, I had a family and I, you know, I stopped doing psychedelic drugs, both because, you know, they were less available, and then because, you know, I had responsibilities and it was still illegal. So I stopped doing them. But I never forgot that insight and others that continued to inform my life in a positive way. So I knew that, you know, despite this sort of, you know, decades of vilification that these drugs sort of experienced in the wider culture, I knew that they had value. So, okay, so that's part of the story. But at the same period when I was in college, I had grown up in Sarasota, Florida, and I was home on spring break or something. And somehow I heard about that there was this like hippie who was building this magnificent house in the woods not far from where I lived. And I was the editor of this college newspaper there. And I decided for whatever reason that this would make an interesting feature. And so I went out and I found this guy working on his house. And he had, you know, he's like this guy with this head of curly hair, and he was working bare chested, and he had this pet wolf tied up in the yard that he would go and play with, and he'd like stick his jaw in the wolf's mouth, and he was quite a character. And I thought his philosophy was really interesting, and I still had that story, and I went back and looked at it, and it doesn't ever mention anything about psychedelic drugs. But I think my interest in it at the time, and certainly, you know, my thought that the student readers of the paper would be interested, had to do with the fact that he was like trying to make the sort of insights you get on psychedelic drugs manifest in normal reality. And that his whole house, he had this like gigantic stained glass window with a white bearded man releasing a dove over a rainbow, and, you know, yeah. Everything in that house sort of was a concrete expression of this kind of tripping philosophy. Yeah. At least that's the way it struck me. So I thought that was really interesting. So I wrote the story and it ran. And 10 years later, I was the editor at the Miami Herald Sunday magazine called Tropic. And I just saw a story in a Tampa newspaper about this sort of perpetual college student who was sort of declaring that this new psychedelic drug called ecstasy was the key to renewing psychotherapy, and that this was the future of psychotherapy, and it was this sort of wonder psychotherapy drug. And as I'm reading this, something about it sort of rang a bell, and then I looked at it more closely, and I thought, oh my God, that's the guy who was building the house in the woods.
The author of the article?
No, he wasn't the author. He was the subject of the article.
Oh, he was the subject. Okay.
Right. And I said, that's unbelievable. I just couldn't believe it was the same guy. So I assigned a very capable reporter to go over there, and he did a cover story on him. And I think that, you know, the headline inside was a Tim Leary for the 80s.
Quotes, hippie guy 10 years later, did he have some kind of credentials as a therapist at that
point? Zero credentials.
Okay.
He was just a totally self-appointed guy, and he was a practicing underground therapist with no credentials whatsoever.
Okay.
Except that he had read about this Then another 15 years go by, and by this time, I'm the editor of the Washington Post Sunday magazine.
Congratulations.
I'm looking in the New York Times, and I see the story about how Harvard has approved the first psychedelic research since they drove Leary out the door. And I'm reading through it, and who's sponsoring this research? that same guy, only now he is a PhD in public policy from the Harvard School, from Kennedy School of Public Policy.
Fantastic.
And he's head of this nonprofit called the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And I said, this is unbelievable. I can't believe this guy, 25 years later is still popping up. So this time I decided I was going to do the story myself. And I called him up, and not only did he remember me, and not only did he had both the story that I had written in college and the story from Tropic 15 years earlier, and not only did he still have them, but he had just shown them to his board of directors, and the point being how far he'd come from a renegade Tim Leary of the 80s to somebody who was dealing with the most respected, institutions of research in the country and successfully getting psychedelic research a new look after basically 30 years in the deep freeze.
That's an incredible story. And I think there are many similar examples of the of people who came of age during that period and who are, quote, countercultural, who went on into academia to research and establish things that were considered to be far out on the fringe at that time, such as, meditation is a really big one that comes to mind. All kinds of research now on meditation and the impact on the brain and so on. So I kind of interrupted you mid-flow, but I wanted to make that observation.
Well, no, but that's a good point, because what I discovered as I began to investigate this was that there were all these highly credentialed, people with impeccable credentials who'd had tremendous careers and huge resumes,
Yes.
Then none of them wanted to admit this. But as I began to work on the book later, I finally, got them to be honest about it. But so many of them were just like me in that they had early experiences, personal experiences with psychedelics that informed them, that told them there's something of real value here. And as they went on and became very successful in their science careers, they never forgot that, but they, for a long time, they never thought it would be possible to use their science to investigate this because it was so stigmatized.
Yes.
And expressing any interest at all was a career killer for them.
Yeah.
But, and that was the really amazing thing was this one guy who wasn't a scientist, Rick Doblin, who was the guy, the hippie in the woods and the Tim Leary of the 80s and then head of this nonprofit, who totally self-made. He'd gone to get his PhD specifically because he thought, well, you know what? Science isn't the problem here. It's politics that are the problem. So I need to learn about, how things are done so that I can deal with them. I don't want to be an underground person. I want this to be mainstream. And it was really because of, so much because of Rick's efforts that these credentialed scientists who'd become part of the mainstream, but who always had this sort of knowledge that, psychedelic drugs were being overlooked, in a horribly sort of transgressive way, because of Rick's efforts, which is really what Acid Test is so much of it is about his history and how he managed to fight these really impossible odds and to have these amazing results. Well, suddenly these people are now able to start doing this research in a serious way. And, it's actually starting to blossom, but it's still not getting the support. If this were any other drug, given the promise that it's shown in clinical psychology, this would be getting tremendous support, both financial and kind of just cultural, from things like the Department of Defense, who's looking at 500,000 people coming home from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan with severe and very difficult to treat PTSD. Well, the early trials using psychedelics, MDMA in particular, to treat PTSD are probably the most promising trials of a novel treatment out there. And yet, and even though, you know, we the taxpayers owe a debt of support to all these returning combat veterans who suffer from this, and to the tune of like $1 trillion over the next 30 years between disability payments and medical treatment for all the related conditions that happen when people have PTSD, that they haven't spent a single dime on helping this research along. So as a result, even though it's, you know, it's in phase two trials, they're getting to the point where they're getting to phase three trials, which is, you know, when they have, you know, that the very, that's the most expensive part, because that's when they have hundreds of subjects over, you know, dozens of locations. And that is what leads to it being approved for as a prescription drug. Well, you know, that they're making such good progress and they're having such promising results that that's almost inevitable that that's going to happen, but it's going to take, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years. And we really can't afford to wait that long. That's the tragedy of the situation.
Yeah, I'm totally in agreement with you about everything that you've said here. Was there anything that surprised you when you researched this book?
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't, even though I had that personal experience where I saw the value, you know, it's one thing for someone to have a good experience, and it's another thing for someone with a really, really pernicious, deep-seated psychological illness to be cured. And so, you know, and also, you know, you might think that people who, you know, who are psychologically might not be good candidates to have this experience, that it could be actually bad for them. I mean, that's certainly, you know, the kind of sense that was out there in the mainstream. And yet when I began to observe tapes and videotapes of these clinic, you know, people gave me permission to see the tapes of their sessions and to interview them about the sessions. And it was just astounding to me how, in many cases, people were almost completely cured. I mean, they really, it really got to the root cause of these problems. It wasn't just treating symptoms. And it wasn't like they had to keep taking these drugs. They took them a few times and they were, you know, they were almost completely cured. And, you know, they did an outside psychiatrist would test them on the standard test for PTSD, and he'd do it before and after. And their scores went from severe to they wouldn't have even been diagnosed in a matter of, you know, instantly.
Wow.
I mean, in a matter of, you know, this the treatment happened several times over the period of a number of weeks. And as soon as they were done with the treatment, you know, they wouldn't even have been able to be classified as having PTSD. And not only that, but even without any further treatment whatsoever, most of these people held on to these gains over a period of, you know, up to 6 years.
Wow.
So that surprised me. I wasn't really expecting that to happen.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can go into more detail about that as we go on. I was very struck by a lot of the background information that the book starts off with, even though this is an area I've, you know, read a lot about over the years. Still, there was a lot of new information for me. And also the way that you put everything together, wove it all together, was very, very skillful.
Thank you. I mean, I wanted this to not read like a polemic,
right,
or a textbook. I wanted it because to me, it was like this epic story. And I wanted to read that way. So,
yeah.
Sort of reads as almost like a novel, which is what I was going for.
Yeah, it does. And, for example, you gave background information on Albert Hofmann, the LSD's inventor, early in the book.
That was what really amazed me about Albert Hofmann, which is so another one of these amazing sort of synchronicities and ironies, is that when Albert Hofmann was a boy, he went out, he lived in Switzerland, and, he'd go for these walks in the woods, and suddenly had this experience in which everything suddenly began to glow with this strange light. And it was like suddenly he saw this sort of almost indescribable beauty of the woods in a way that seemed almost magical to him, just spontaneously. And it so moved him that he decided that he really wanted to be a artist or a poet or something, so he could get this across, because it was so hard to describe. But then he very bitterly decided he didn't have the talent for that. So he kind of went 180 degrees and he became a scientist. He became a chemist. And he was working in these, like, early 20th century labs, where
he was a pretty young man when he started out as a scientist at Sandoz Laboratories, right?
And this was early in pharmaceutical research. It was really the beginning.
And he was in his early 20s, as I recall.
Yes, and he began, and so he was looking for, drugs that would, like, stimulate respiration and the cardiovascular system, and possibly stimulate neural activity. And by sheer accident, he came upon a drug which he synthesized, which had the effect of creating the type of experience that had so moved him by happening spontaneously when he was a boy.
So yeah, that's just an incredible story. I mean, the synchronicity of that happening is mind blowing.
I know that instead of being a poet or an artist who could kind of manage to convey this experience, he created a drug that could actually provide the experience itself. I don't think anybody ever made that connection before.
Well, that's amazing that connection wasn't made before. And he was working on a rye mold called ergot, which has a very interesting history too. So maybe you can give us a taste of that.
Yeah, well ergot, it turns out that back in the Middle Ages and before, really as soon as large-scale agriculture of grains began, every once in a while there'd be this mold that grew on the rye, and people didn't even know it was there. But when they ingested the rye, it caused hallucinations. It disrupted circulation to the point where limbs would turn black and drop off. It could cause convulsions and cause people to writhe around and act insane. And this killed hundreds of thousands of people over many generations before they even knew what it was.
And they called it St. Vitus dance. Is that right?
No. It was fire.
Okay.
Yeah, it was. So what happened was, but at the same time, somehow the sort of healers of those societies discovered that it helped in childbirth, both by stimulating, when applied in small amounts, by stimulating labor, and by getting the blood to stop after childbirth. So midwives had been using this for generations, and so it was one of these sort of folk medicines that the early pharmacological research was looking at, and Hofmann's. And they'd learned how to. Sandoz was the first to synthesize and be able to produce at will this active ingredient in Ergo that was, you know, that had most of these bioactive symptoms. And so Hoffman was looking at ergobasine was the name of the element that they found that was the active element. And so and the main principle of that was lysergic acid. And so Hoffman was combining this with other known sort of biologically active compounds. And he did an ammonia extract that we called diethylamide that he combined with he was playing God here, which is by combining these substances just to see what would happen. And so the German acronym for lysergic acid combined with diethylamide was LSD. And this particular compound was the 25th that he had been experimenting with. So the lab designated it as LSD-25. And so he did this and what he discovered was not much. It wasn't as good as some of the, you know, the principles they were looking for was something that had an effect on circulation or something that had, you know, some kind of muscular effect. But the effect wasn't as great as some of the other compounds they came up with. And aside from this sort of odd sort of restiveness in the test animals that they noticed, they found nothing remarkable about it. So they just kind of dumped it off. And here's the other really sort of eerie part about this. Hoffman, in spite of the fact that this was just another in one of the many compounds that he'd done, and that, you know, it just didn't sort of ring any bells for anybody. He, however, had what he described as this odd presentiment that there was something special about LSD-25 to the point where 5 years later, he resynthesized it. And, you know, and he can't really explain why he felt that this was significant. But
oh, wow. Yeah, I didn't realize there was that 5 year.
Yes, it was 5 years later. He just kept it in his mind all that time. And he resynthesized it. And when he was in that process, he suddenly started feeling very odd to the point where he had to leave work. And he ended up lying on his couch and having these like weird visions and seeing all these colors and everything. And he didn't know what it was. And he couldn't believe it was the LSD because he'd been exposed, you know, his minimal, he worked with it with great care. And that the only exposure he could have had was to just a minute amount, you know, on through his skin. And he didn't think that, you know, that it could have possibly given an enough exposure to cause those effects. So he was looking at like the formaldehyde that was in his lab. He was like sniffing it. No, nothing happened and everything. And when he eliminated everything else, he decided it had to be the LSD. So he decided without telling anybody except his lab assistant, that he was going to experiment on himself. So he took what he thought would be, you know, like maybe 1,000 times less dose than anything that would have an effect. Because, you know, that's the way when you're doing self-experimentation, you take a fragment of what you think will be active and then you increase it very slowly until you feel something, just so you try not to totally poison yourself.
Yeah.
Well, he took this tiny fragment, what he thought was a fraction of anything that could possibly have an effect. And suddenly he wrote one sentence in his lab notes and then he couldn't write anymore. And he had to get his lab assistant to take him home. And since this was in the middle of World War II, they didn't have car. There were no cars available. So they had to ride back to his place on bicycles, which has become known as Bicycle Day among acid aficionados.
Yeah.
And when he got, he thought he might have poisoned himself and he might be going permanently crazy. And these fears influenced, you know, what he would learn later was that your mindset going into a psychedelic experience is very important in shaping the experience itself. And because he went into it uncertain and fearful, he had kind of a scary experience. And he thought he had poisoned himself, and he was gulping milk, which is sort of this sort of generic antidote for poisons. But a doctor came when he was in the height throes of this, and he had no physiological issues at all. You know, his eyes were a little dilated, and his heart rate was a little bit high. But other than that, he had zero physical symptoms. And this eventually just died down. And the next morning he woke up and he just had the sense that everything was fresh and beautiful and new. And he had this tremendous sense of vitality. And he realized that he had discovered a very important psychoactive drug. And so he continued to test it on himself. And it was only in his subsequent experiences where he experienced that kind of mystical moment of the kind that he had when he was a child. And he realized that, you know, that it was capable of producing some, you know, these sort of almost miraculous sort of sensations of oneness with the universe, et cetera. All those kind of things that you hear people say in trying to describe an LSD experience. But also they began sending them out to labs around the world. And, you know, again, this is a long and complex story, but eventually psychiatrists realized that this could, you know, that they'd been doing like Freudian psychoanalysis for years, and this was a long, slow process that very often never really had any kind of dramatic positive results. I mean, it went on for years, famously, and very often people just never got better. And there was one psychiatrist in particular, a guy named Stan Grof,
I've interviewed Stan, as a matter of fact.
Well, and Stan was like thinking about getting out of the biz because he felt that that it was so long and expensive a process and the results were so paltry. When he was a monitor in one of these early experiments where they gave people LSD, and he decided he really wanted to do it himself, but he was still a student and he was prohibited. So as soon as he graduated, he volunteered for one of these trials, and he had this experience, this life-changing experience that set him on a course to become the single personhood, the most experienced of anybody in using psychedelic drugs for psychotherapy.
Yeah, he came up in Prague, and you pointed out that actually he had more experience that I didn't realize. You reported that he had treated some 15,000 people using LSD for various psychological issues.
Yes, which is almost certainly more than anybody else alive or in history.
Yeah, he could do that because he was in Prague, right?
Well, I mean, and that's the other thing that was surprising to me. Maybe the main thing that I didn't know, because it's almost been completely forgotten, which is that, you know, between the early 1950s, which is when Sandoz sent out all those samples in it and people began to use it for psychotherapy, into the early 1960s and even to the mid-1960s, that psychedelics were being used with great success to treat a whole variety of psychiatric conditions with huge success. And people really felt that this was revolutionizing psychiatry and that it was the future. And the results were almost universally positive. They were using it to treat alcoholism in Canada, depression, all sorts of neuroses, with great success, even autism, eating disorders, things like that. It was being used in marriage counseling. And the thing was that it wasn't like penicillin where you have an infection, you take penicillin and the infection goes away and you have no idea why. I mean, it just happens without. This was actually, people were changing as a result of the experience itself and the insights that they had. So this might have been affecting biochemical conditions in the brain, but people were, the way people were experiencing it were that they were having these insights and these experiences that were changing them in really fundamental ways. And so, so this was going on for 15 to 20 years before suddenly it got out in the counterculture and the society had this kind of fear reaction to it. And they shut it down, and they made it a Schedule I drug like heroin, and you know they were like trying to stamp out all recreational use, which of course they failed to do. However, all these laws that came up in around 1970 was remarkably effective in stamping out research to the point where, as one researcher told me, it was almost as if psychedelics had been undiscovered. And then as little now, you know, 30, 40 years later, most people don't even know that there ever was a period where it was actively being used for psychotherapy, much less that it was being used with tremendous promise.
Yes. Yeah. I was surprised to read, if I understood correctly, that that Hoffman actually got onto the importance of set and setting before Timothy Leary did, who was sort of famously attached to the idea of the importance of set and setting.
Oh, yes. I mean, he very early on his trips, as I said, you know, because his first trip, he didn't know what he'd ingested and had no idea what its effects were. You know, he was fearful, and as a result, he had this fearful trip. But later, after, you know, animal testing showed that it was remarkably non-toxic, given its powerful effects, and he took it in a, he realized that he needed to take it in a positive and aesthetically pleasing environment in a secure situation, and he wasn't afraid anymore. That's when he had some of these glowing sort of life-changing positive experiences. And so it became very obvious to him that, you know, that your mindset going into it and the conditions under which you were taking it, i.e. set and setting, was sort of uniquely important with this drug.
Now, another historical bit that you cover is the contributions of Osman and Hoffer in Canada. And those were two names that I was familiar with, but you give a lot of detail that I wasn't familiar with. Give us some of the highlights of their work.
Well, Humphrey Osman was a British psychiatrist, and he believed that, as many people originally did, was that maybe this very puzzling, this very puzzling disease, psychosis, might be caused by a chemical in the brain. And the fact that LSD had such huge impact on one's perception, and in fact, originally people thought it kind of mimicked psychosis. So this was very exciting to him because he thought, oh, well, this might be proof that, you know, that I'm right, you know, that something akin to LSD is causing the psychosis. But when he began, they weren't interested in pursuing that in England. So he went all the way to Saskatchewan to this like remote mental hospital basically in the wilds of Canada, where he was able to do the research he wanted to do. And when he started having, you know, first of all, he just investigated the effects of the drug itself. And when he began to see these sort of positive, spiritual, almost religious experiences as a result of the drug, he realized that this really wasn't the same as psychosis at all, and that, in fact, that experience might be very healing. And he began to use it to treat alcoholism, which, you know, was notoriously difficult to get an alcoholic to be, you know, permanently free of the, of that. And yet they had great success to the point where the government of Canada said this was no longer an experimental treatment. It was a proven treatment for alcoholism. And he has another interesting place in history, which was his work caught the attention of Aldous Huxley, who, and Huxley, you know, the author of Brave New World and other, he was a world famous author at that time.
Yes.
And he had created this fictional drug called Soma, which, if you read the description of it in Brave New World, it almost sounds a little bit like a psychedelic drug. And so, of course, he was very interested in this. So he wrote Osman a letter and volunteered to come be part of his research. And Osman happened to be Huxley lived in California, and Osman happened to be going to a conference there. So he told him, I'm going to come and I'm going to bring some mescaline, which is another naturally occurring psychedelic, from peyote cactus. And he brought some synthetic mescaline and turned Aldous Huxley on for the first time. And Huxley had this amazing experience in which he sort of felt like he saw, you know, the wellspring behind all of creation. And he wrote a very famous book about it called The Doors of Perception, which was interesting. And then there's this great thing where Osman and Huxley have this afterwards, have this correspondence in which they're kind of competing to think up a name for this class of drugs. And they're not only are they thinking of it, but they're doing it in rhyme. And Huxley came up with something like Fantamarime or something like that. And then Osman, and you wouldn't think you'd want to get in a literary competition with Aldous Huxley if you're Humphrey Osman. But Osman then wrote back this little ditty, you know, about how to plumb the depths of hell or soar angelic, just take a pinch of psychedelic. And, you know, so oddly, Osman was the one who won that competition. And
so that's how psychedelic got into our language.
Yes. And it's actually perfect because what it means is mind manifest. So the experience of psychedelics is really not an experience in your physical body so much as it is, you know, an experience in your brain and in your mind and perception. So it kind of was the perfect name for it.
Well, then you go on to talk about Nazi scientists testing the effect of mescaline on prisoners and concentration camps, and after the war, how their journals inspired the CIA to begin its own experiments on unsuspecting subjects. So maybe you can take us through a little bit of that dark history.
Yeah, well, it's very dark. And you know, and anything that starts with, you know, Nazis' medical experimentation is about as dark as it gets. You know, they were doing things like they were throwing concentration camp people into, like, freezing water just to see how long it took them to die. But they were also, you know, they had come across, in the early 20th century, Westerners had discovered that these, that some cultures in South America, Central America, in Africa, and India used various substances to create these kind of religious states. And one of them was mescaline in Central America. And there was a brief moment of real interest in this, but it kind of flagged. But the Nazis got a hold of this stuff and they wondered whether it could be used as a interrogation drug. And so they did it and they had mixed results. But of course, after the war, when the Allies captured all the Nazis, scientific research, they saw this, and the new organization called the CIA decided, and as well as the Army, both decided, they spent years researching this as a as some kind of weapon, you know, see if they could weaponize it somehow. And it got to the point where the CIA had, they actually were operating a brothel in San Francisco, and they would attract men in and then dose their drinks without telling anybody with LSD and then observe them. And, you know, this is, again, set and setting comes in, because if this happens to you and you don't know why, and you don't even know you had a drug acting on you, it could create tremendous fear to the point of suicide in some cases. And certainly people had bad reactions. They were unscreened, so some of them might have had psychiatric problems to begin with. So this caused a lot of havoc and did a lot of damage. But at the same time, it created a black market, because in these, you know, they were just basically handing this stuff out and dosing people all over the place without any controls. And they were also funding research in universities secretly. And so this was creating, you know, scores and scores of people who had this experience, many of whom had positive experiences in spite of the fact that they weren't good settings for it. And one of them was a guy named Ken Kesey.
Yeah.
And Kesey was, you know, he was also a writer, and he wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And in fact, he was inspired to write One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest while taking acid. And he actually wrote the first few pages of it during an acid trip. So the popularization of this drug, so really, and then another person who had the experience through CIA-funded research was a guy named Owsley, who was so impressed with the drug that he decided he was going to learn to synthesize it himself. And he spent 3 weeks at the Berkeley Library, taught himself how to synthesize the drug, and then made thousands of doses of it. And he fueled this whole sort of summer of love psychedelic party in the Bay Area. And this exploded, you know, it got popularized, and this is what's, and then there was, you know, these rash of people sort of doing it in foolish situations and ending up in emergency rooms. And then of course the press got a hold of this and sort of blew it up out of all proportion. And just the very nature of the psychedelic experience was sort of, you know, connected with the whole idea of a counterculture that was perceived as trying to tear down everything that America was about, et cetera, all that stuff. To the point where Richard Nixon famously said that Tim Leary was the most dangerous man in America. And Leary, who had started off as a research scientist, just like so many other people who are working very productively in that area, ended up deciding he was going to throw away all the rules of science and become an advocate for everybody using this drug. And he became this popularizer instead of a scientist. And so that was what, in the end, provoked this backlash that ultimately shut down all legitimate research.
Yeah. So we've been talking about some of the background history of psychedelics, and in your book, this is really only takes up a chapter or so. But the rest of the book has a very interesting structure, kind of focusing on two or three people's experiences and I guess, psychological issues. So tell us about the structure of the book. And
well, when I was writing Acid Test, this was what really preoccupied me for a long time was, you know, how could I structure it? Because, you know, and eventually I just sort of found that really this could, the whole story with the background, the history and the science could be told through the lives of three people. And one of them was Rick Doblin, who, you know, the guy, the hippie in the woods who ended up sort of founding this nonprofit and educating himself about both the science and the politics to a point where he overcame three decades of extreme prejudice against these drugs to restart scientific research. So he was one, and his roots stretched all the way back through Stan Grof, who he studied with. And Stan Grof, of course, had the connection to Hoffman, because Stan Grof had his first LSD experience courtesy of Albert Hoffman, who sent, and Sandoz, who sent the drugs out. So Rick went all the way back to the sort of the roots of the discovery of LSD, which was really the beginning of the modern science of the brain. And then Michael Mithofer, who was an emergency room physician in Charleston, South Carolina, who came to feel that he was always on the wrong end of these issues, because he'd be treating people who had stab wounds, who had overdoses, et cetera. And, you know, he felt like he'd be jamming a breathing tube down their throats or stitching them up. And he felt that the real problem was not what he was presented with in the emergency room. The real problem was this whole sort of pathological lifestyle that they led that got them there in the first place. So he decided he really wanted to be on the other end of that, on the preventative end, to help people sort of deal with the life problems that they had and the psychological problems that, you know, that would eventually get them into these sort of, you know, life-threatening situations. And he also didn't want to just be doing things to people all the time. He wanted to be collaborating with them. So this led him to psychiatry. And of course, as I said earlier, he was one of those people who had this powerful experiences with psychedelics when he was a college student that always were in the back of his mind and made him think that maybe there was some real power there, a kind of a healing power. And he became interested in all these examples of non-Western cultures that did use altered states of consciousness in their healing procedures. And he discovered Stan Grof as well. And at this point, after, you know, research with psychedelics was made illegal, Grof had sort of looked around and made that same conclusion that it wasn't the drugs that was doing the healing. It was the altered state of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And that he was looking for a non-drug way to create an altered state of consciousness. And of course, non-Western cultures have long been doing things, even in Western cultures, and things like chanting, breathing, you know, heavy breathing,
yeah.
Loud rhythmic music have gotten people into altered state of consciousness for thousands of years. And so he sort of developed this technique that he called holotropic breath work, where, you know, a combination of kind of like hyperventilation and loud rhythmic music would get people into an altered state of consciousness. And mm-hmm. he'd observe many of the same effects as people who were undergoing therapy with LSD. So Michael Mithofer studied this and decided he wanted that to be part of his psych, and he became a psychiatrist instead of an emergency room doctor. And he began treating people, a lot of people with trauma, with PTSD, in fact, using breath work. But he also knew that that didn't work for some people, and he knew that the psychedelic drugs had a lot of power, and he felt that it was sort of crazy to just rule that out, and he wanted to research that. And so he met Rick at a conference, and he said, I really want to research psychedelics, but I know I can't do it in this country, so can you tell me what country I may be able to do it in? And in the meantime, Rick was having trouble finding anybody with proper credentials who was even willing to risk working with it because it was such a career killer. And so here's the site. And he said to Michael, well, are you a psychiatrist? And Michael said, yes. And he goes, well, then you can work with me and we can do it here. And so that was the kind of the beginning mm-hmm. of, of course, they had to go through an unbelievable ordeal to get it off the ground, but that was the inception. So then the third person I focused it on was a vet who had horrible combat experiences in Iraq that gave him PTSD that almost killed him when he got home. He felt that he was going to have to commit suicide. And, you know, he got to the point of like holding a service revolver to his temple and getting ready to pull the trigger. And he was, you know, he was at the end of his rope basically when he just happened to see this notice that Michael and Rick Doblin had put up that they were doing clinical trials for PTSD for veterans with combat related PTSD.
Now, was this through a university or?
That's another story. Originally, it was going to be through a university in Charleston, but they backed out because of political pressure. So then they had to go through this whole thing where Michael got permission to do it out of his private psychiatric office.
Uh-huh.
And then it took years for them to get an institutional review board, which is required for all sort of human experimentation with drugs, to approve of it. And they had like four or five of them back out on them, again, because of political pressure. So it just... You know, that whole process is a big part of the story, and it shows how, you know, how incredibly stigmatized and how long it's delayed this research. But anyway, the veteran whose name is Nicholas Blackston is a big part of the book, and I wanted people to really experience what he experienced in Iraq and how that manifested itself in PTSD and how awful PTSD really is. Because I felt that, you know, for this to have the necessary impact, that I couldn't, that too often stories like this will just sort of treat the, the people with PTSD almost as if they're, you know, a priority. They have a problem and they don't really get into the causes of the problem or make you feel it. But so anyway, he's a big part of the book, and ultimately his sessions with MDMA, with Michael Midhoffer and Midhoffer's co-therapist is his wife, Annie. And they were remarkable, those sessions. And you could see Nick having these insights that were unbelievably dramatic. And that's kind of the climax of the book, is when he undergoes this treatment and how that affects him.
Can you give an example of one of those insights that were transformative for him?
Oh, tremendously. I mean, and again, he had very severe PTSD, and by the time he was done with his treatment, he wouldn't have even qualified as of having a mild case.
I'm not sure if you heard me correctly. I was asking if you could recall an example.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, on his very first session out of three, he had this vision where he was, you know, he was using a meditative technique where you kind of went to this comforting place. You imagined yourself.
Yes.
Only under the influence of MDMA, this imagining took on a life of its own. And so he was like going down to, you know, to this place where he felt peaceful and comfortable, only he got down there and the landscape was kind of scary instead of comforting. And he was like being led to this prison, and he was like really scared and felt there was something horrible in there. And then when he gets to the prison door, he sees this monster, only the monster is wearing a Marine uniform, and it's him as a monster.
Wow.
As a killer.
Yeah.
And so he's looking at himself, and then suddenly he realizes that he's the one who put that monster there, and that it wasn't, and he wasn't really evil. It was just he just had to do these things because he was in a war, and he was in a situation where it was either kill or be killed. And so he decides that he has to unchain him, and he unchains him. And then he embraces this thing that he's kept locked up in his mind all this time. And there's just this tremendously liberating thing where he kind of forgave himself for what he had to do in war.
This is almost like your story in the beginning of discovering that you were carrying this huge stone of anxiety and that you had a choice and could let go of it.
Yes, it was very much that. And of course, you know, so much of psychiatric distress is, you know, not being able to deal with trauma. And so he had this, you know, tremendous relief as a result of that. And he had to do things like he was a turret machine gunner in a Humvee. That was, and his job was to keep that vehicle safe. And so at one point, these two kids, they might have been 12 years old, come out of an alley and they've got AK-47s that they're just firing at him. And he had no choice but to get on his 50 caliber machine gun and blow them away. And yet, you know, this was not what he imagined when he signed up for the Marines. He thought he was going to be, you know, fighting professional soldiers and jihadists and terrorists and such, not 12-year-old kids.
Yeah.
So he felt, part of him felt like he was a murderer, and then, you know, maybe he didn't have to do that. Or another time, a car came out of an alley right after, in the middle of a firefight, and, you know, the mantra is, do tires, grill, kill. In other words, shoot the tires out first. Then if that doesn't work, shoot out the engine block. And if that doesn't work, then you go for the driver. Well, on a 50 caliber machine gun and during the middle of a firefight, those are pretty fine distinctions to make. So it was like tires, grill, kill all at once.
Yeah.
And he didn't know, you know, he thought it was suspicious that this guy came out, that he should have heard the firefight, and why would he be coming out if he didn't have a bomb or something, but he never knew for sure. And so many of the trauma in war is from those ambiguous situations where, you know, you don't know whether, you know, you really are, you know, killing innocent people or what. And he also got blown up himself. His Humvee got hit by a rocket propelled grenade, and his close friend, the driver, who's right at his feet, when he got out, he sort of jumped out and he was injured, but he yelled at the guy to get out. And he said, I can't move. And he watched his best friend like bleed out right in front of him.
Wow.
So all of these really, really horrible experiences are very difficult to process.
And yet you say it only took 3 sessions of a psychedelic treatment.
Yes, really. I mean, you know, he's still working at it. But it gave him the tools. One subject in one of these studies said, well, it wasn't like I was instantly better, but I felt like I kind of lifted above myself. And I saw that I was in the middle of the woods, but unlike before where I just felt lost, I suddenly saw that there was a path out of that woods. And that if I followed that path, I'd eventually get free of it. Well, you know, so what it did was it showed them that there was hope, and that there was a path that they could follow to sort of deal. And from then on, you know, instead of sort of freaking out when they ran into obstacles, they were able to use the tools that they sort of saw during their sessions to help them deal with them.
A fair number of people are going down to South America again these days, this time for ayahuasca. And I just wonder if in your research you found out anything about ayahuasca.
In fact, the emergency room physician turned psychiatrist, who's the chief researcher in some of these MDMA trials, when he was, he was persuaded that it was altered states that were the healing influence, he went down to Peru to do this, week or 2 week long series of ayahuasca sessions with a shaman down there.
Yes.
Experience what that was like, and had some really profound experiences. The culmination of which was that, you know, he was having this really sort of feeling of desperation and everything. And he was like feeling like he was down in a pit, which resonated for him because he had a bad LSD trip in college where he felt he was in this pit and trapped and was never going to get out. And so once again, here he was back in this pit of despair, actually. And then he saw this can. It was like an anchovy, a big anchovy can. And he peeled it open, and there was all this wriggling, nasty stuff in it. And he realized, those are my fears and my anxieties. And he says, it's just crap in a can. and then he suddenly emerged, and it was like he realized that that he'd been carrying this around with him, and it was so much better when you like saw it as it was, you know, just crap in a can, and that kind of liberated him from it. So,
wow. Yeah.
So a lot of people are, you know, again, it's just frustrating to think that the research is going so slowly here, and that, you know, that the access of, and that's why people do things like go down to South America to do this, because it's just not available in a legal way.
Is it starting to open up? Where do you see it going? I've kind of heard rumors, but I haven't really investigated it, that there are some labs that are doing legitimate research now.
Oh, no, that's part of a big part of the book, is that the legitimate research is proceeding apace. Places, you know, Harvard is doing it, Johns Hopkins, NYU, UCLA, a lot of very prestigious institutions. You know, Johns Hopkins just did a pilot study of using psilocybin, which is magic mushrooms, the element that's in magic mushrooms,
to
help people quit smoking. And they, you know, had an 80% success rate, which is almost unheard of after 6 months, which is almost unheard of.
Yes, right.
In smoking cessations, where the best sort of drug-aided treatment that they have currently is, you know, does well to do 35%. Also, they've been giving it to people who have terminal cancer, who are paralyzed by fear and bitterness over their diagnosis, and you know the kind of transcendent experiences that people are having. Help them to see their remaining life as being what's important, as opposed to their impending death, and to understand that, you know, we all are living with a death sentence on us, and that shouldn't stop us from being able to appreciate the moment. And so they're finding that is having a very high success rate in greatly diminishing anxiety and refocusing people on, you know, the time they have left rather than on their impending death. It's being used. There's a new trial beginning now where they're giving MDMA to adults with autism social disorders. And that anecdotally has tremendous promise. So, I mean, there's a lot. Oh, and it's also, you know, being used to treat addiction. Ibogaine is another psychedelic drug that has a part of it that diminishes or eliminates withdrawal symptoms. But then it's coupled with the insight gained that changes the way people perceive how they're treating their bodies, so that they just naturally don't want it. Take drugs anymore. So there's a tremendous amount of stuff, and these are all in, like, you know, there are three phases of clinical trials. The first phase establishes whether it can be given safely under medical supervision. They don't, you know, that's all that it's concerned with. Can they treat people without killing them or injuring them? And then the second phase actually tries to see whether it has an effect that seems to be positive in small groups of people, you know, ranging between like a dozen and two dozen subjects. And that's what they're completing now. They completed one such study with MDMA for mainly female victims of sex or rape, sex abuse or rape. And then now they're nearing completion of the veteran study that Nick Blackston was in. You know, they've got 21 of 24 subjects. But and there are other phase two trials going on in multiple states and other countries. And when they get enough of those, you know, maybe a couple hundred total people, then they go ahead with the phase three, which, as I said, is, you know, several hundred subjects in, you know, maybe a half dozen locations. And that's what leads to prescription. But, you know, it's very expensive. And as I said, no government funding is forthcoming. So, you know, MAPS, which is Rick Doblin's nonprofit, is doing things like Indiegogo campaigns and stuff. It's absurd. You know, the phase three trials will probably, you know, cost $10 million or more. And so it's very slow to raise that kind of money. And the lack, you know, the fact that they're doing it in dribs and drabs stretches it all out. So, yes, because this works, and, you know, I'm not a scientist, so I can just say flat out it works. You know, if I was a scientist, I'd have to hedge and say, well, you know, you can't tell until you do all the, you know, until you do the phase three trials, et cetera, which is often true in drugs, where positive early results don't translate to results when you do it with a lot of people. But this is not a usual case because, as I said, this was being used widely for 15 years with great success. So it's not really the same situation. And but anyway, it will eventually be a prescription drug therapy. I mean, it will never be where you go to the CVS and they give you LSD. What will happen is you'll get a prescription for therapy in a clinic.
Sure.
But you know, that's at least a minimum of 10 years away. And I think it's going to, everything is, takes much longer than everybody thinks it's going to take. This study that they've now done 21 out of 24 subjects. Originally he thought that he was going to be done and publishing a paper on it by the time my book came out, which was in September of 2014. And they still have three subjects left. And then it takes like another, you know, 9 months to a year to get a paper written and published.
Yeah. Well, Tom, I know that you've got to run on to another interview, and so you might want to mention your book and where people can get it, and any last words that you want to close
with. Yeah, no, the book is called Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal. And, you know, of course, the easiest thing to do is just to go on Amazon and look it up and do that one-click thing. You know, I really hope that, you know, I've already seen evidence that this has elevated the discussion and gotten more people talking about it. You know, I've been on NPR, and Time Magazine, Psychology Today, The Atlantic. It's been all over the place. And I really feel that, people are learning about this, and I hope that that continues. But thank you very much, David. I'm talking with you.
Yeah, well, me too. Tom Schroeder, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio, and I'm sorry that all those other publications got to you before I did, but I'm really glad the word's getting out there.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
I hope you found this interview to be as fascinating as I did. There's so much more in the book than we were able to cover. As you heard, Tom Schroeder, the author, experimented with psychedelics in his youth, as so many of us did in the mid-60s and early 70s. I've already been pretty open here that, as one of that generation, I also explored them, and as with Tom, my interest was not driven by a desire to party, but rather I felt as a graduate student psychologist that it behooved me to explore what I was hearing was a potentially powerful therapeutic tool. It's been about 50 years since I've taken a psychedelic, so I figure the statute of limitations has probably run out by now, and I can afford to be open about it. Clearly, both Tom and I were able to go on and lead productive lives, as did so many others who have enjoyed successful academic research and therapeutic careers. There was a small percentage who did not fare well as a result of their experimentation. However, because of the illegality of these substances, we have no way of knowing for sure what they took, its potency, purity, and so on. Neither Tom nor I are advocating that you experiment with these powerful substances, but I do think we both are advocates for high-quality research that may lead to powerful interventions which are adjuncts to more conventional psychotherapy. It seems to me that the whole trend toward legalizing medical marijuana may be an important step along the path of backing off from the demonization of these potentially healing plant-based medicines. Just last night, I was watching CNN and the second hour-long special by neuroscientist and author Dr. Sanjay Gupta on medical marijuana. He described important research going on in Europe and Israel. It's still very hard to mount the needed research here in the U.S. because approval involves obtaining approval not only from NIMH, that's the National Institutes of Mental Health, but also various law enforcement agencies. He points out the paradoxical situation in the case of medical marijuana, in which the government has taken out a patent on one strain while declaring it illegal. University-based researchers in this country are intimidated by the legal risks that they might incur by mounting research studies on marijuana. So here in the U.S., we are stymied by a kind of catch-22 in which medical marijuana is legal in a growing number of states, but illegal nationally. We can only hope this situation will continue to change for the better. I definitely recommend Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal by Tom Schroeder. And as always, let me remind you that you can order that book using our Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio website.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Morgan Adolfsen from Norway, clinical psychologist. I've been a long-time listener to both Wise Counsel and Shrink Wrap Radio. Today, I'm so happy that I pressed the donate button. So from this day, I will regularly contribute to support your shows, and I really appreciate your work, Dave. So, good luck. Thank you.
Thank you, clinical psychologist Morgan Adolfsen, for your ongoing commitment. Just today, I noticed your first PayPal donation coming in for 2015. I thank you so much for your ongoing commitment, and I hope others will be inspired to follow your excellent example. And speaking of donations, I'm pleased to announce that we have a new transcript on the site, thanks to the donated labor of listener Nick Munson, who's provided us with a transcription of Shrink Wrap Radio number 410, A Research-Based View of Mindfulness and Health, with Harvard psychologist Ellen Langer, Ph.D. So I think that's a really important one, so thank you for your work on this, Nick Munson. You know, I've been announcing that you could save money on my continuing education courses through the Zur Institute by using my discount code of DrDave88. That's DrDav88. What I didn't realize and probably did not get across to you is that 10% discount code applies not just to the courses based on my Shrink Wrap Radio interviews, but to all 170 courses plus clinical practice materials that are offered through the ZurInstitute.com website. So really, this is a wonderful one-stop place for all you professionals to get your continuing education needs met. You'll find a link to the Zur Institute on the left-hand sidebar on our site, or you can just go to www.zurinstitute.com. That's Z-U-R, Z-U-R, and use the discount code DrDave88 for 10% on everything they offer there. And speaking of discounts, our strategic partner, once again, the Jung Platform, is also offering a discount on their ongoing course on alchemy with Jungian analysts Robbie Bosnack and Patricia Berry, both of whom I've interviewed here, and they are wonderful. And the 10 sessions of this course are spread out over 2 years. It gives you plenty of time to study and digest the material. You can attend the 10 live webinar sessions, and you'll also receive an audio recording of each session for any that maybe you are not able to attend. And you can find the dates and other details on our Shrink Wrap Radio website under the Partners tab. The cost for the course is $150, but that's before you take your 15% discount by using the code DrDave. And that's just DrDave. And finally, let me give you this week's Audible.com recommendation. I'm sure you enjoyed today's interview with journalist Tom Schroeder. Well, it turns out that his book, Acid Test, LSD, Ecstasy, and the Power to Heal, is available on Audible.com. As steeped as I am in the literature surrounding this topic, I learned a lot that I didn't know from his book, and it came across in a lively, personable, and personal style of delivery that I'm sure you'll enjoy and benefit from. And if you're not already a subscriber to Audible.com, it can be yours for free to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription. It can be yours just by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. Or, instead of that one, if you wish, you can get any one of their other 165,000 titles.
Hi, this is Dr. Elisha Goldstein, psychologist, workshop leader, and author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Dr. Elisha Goldstein, who will be my guest on the next episode. More about that in a bit. First, let's take a quick dip into the old email bag, and I'll read just one. And it's from Matt in London. And Matt writes, "Hi, David. Well, it's taken 4 months to respond, but then it did take me about a year and a half to get around to setting up my regular contribution. It was probably that great episode about the, quotes, the overwhelmed that made me think about why don't I find the time to do some things I consider important, such as make the support commitment. I was pleased to have done so when subsequent podcast featured your revelation, spurred by a mail from Sven, by recollection, and further exchanges about how you had struggled with whether or not to implement the paywall. I'm glad that you made a decision to stay in alignment with your values and stick to voluntary support. I do hope that debate prompted others who, like me, had planned to, but not previously found the time. You received quite a bit of advice on how to get more revenue, but I think you concluded that with contributions being the most realistic source. I understand the value of having the personal call to action clips from contributors. I will try to do that one day. But I wonder if that might put some people off contributing, i.e. they feel that they will be obliged to also do the audio. Therefore, it may be worth mentioning that you write a thank you note, which does also include a clip request, but that it's not required that they submit an audio. Otherwise, just as in my case, you leave the contributor alone to be a, quote, silent supporter. I'm one of your listeners not in the head-shrinking business, but avidly consuming each episode for my own personal benefit. Although after hearing all this great content, I do find myself dabbling a bit in amateur psychoanalysis, exclamation point. I think it was because I became interested in positive psychology that I started looking around for a podcast on the subject. However, having discovered Shrink Wrap Radio, I've been drawn into the many and varied mind-related subjects you cover and how they may apply to me and all the people that I try and relate to. One of the great things about Shrink Wrap is that occasionally there is a topic that doesn't sound of personal interest, but typically after a few minutes, I'm grabbed by a new perspective. Indeed, there's almost always a profound takeaway, a nugget to make a note of for those moments when I consider personal change and how to try and accomplish it. Another part of the value of being a regular listener, and I am as appreciative as all those who leave audio comments or write endorsements for the email bag, I particularly appreciate your relaxed but determined interview style. A good example was the recent very good interview with Dr. Josh Gressel, where you teased out a deeper and more conclusive answer at a couple of critical points. I do hope you continue to get some personal intrinsic reward from providing this great service and the motivation to keep it coming. All the best, and that's from Matt in London. And Matt, I really appreciate your taking time to write. And I also appreciate your suggestion that maybe my invitation to people who've made a contribution, you know, my suggestion that they could submit a bit of audio to encourage others, maybe I should follow up on your suggestion of having it be clear that I'm not requiring that. And because I would hate it if somebody was reluctant to make a contribution for fear that they would have to appear on audio. So I hope all of you who are listening, if any of you are in that situation where you've held off because you thought maybe you would be put on the spot in that way, well, I'm announcing here and now that that's not the case. It's good to hear from people who are not in the head shrinking business and to know that you're finding content here that is relevant to you, to your life, to the people that you know, and also to hear that there are times when you think that you're not going to be interested in the topic, but then as you take a little listen, you discover that you are. And I've heard that from other people, and so I want everybody who's listening to take that to heart and at least give it a try for a while, because you might be surprised. Maybe you'll be more interested than you thought. So with that, I better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to journalist Tom Schroeder for sharing highlights from his book and his personal journey in relation to psychedelics and healing. And as you heard, my next show will be with return guest Elisha Goldstein, and we'll be discussing his new book, Uncovering Happiness, Overcoming Depression with Mindfulness and Self-Compassion. So I hope you'll be mindful and join us. And until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.